Hello and welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel. I'm Nicholas Barrett. This week we'll be asking what Brexit means, not just for Britain, but for the EU too. Joining me today is Guntram Wolf, the director of Bruegel, and our special guest, Calypso Nicolaidis. She is Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford. Calypso is also the author of Exodus, Reckoning, Sacrifice, Three Meanings of Brexit, and joins us in the studio. So to kick off, why don't you tell us about these three meanings, Exodus, Reckoning, and Sacrifice? What do they mean?
These are my readings of the mood music or the mood fury or the mood noise, depending on how you hear it, that we've had around us ever since the vote in June 2016. And I, as a Franco-Greek expat in Britain, having lived there for 20 years, was plunged in this fury with great passion, but also with an analytical eye and with a certain sensitivity, because I found myself, as I listened to the different ways of thinking Brexit and speaking Brexit, my old, my childhood, really, when I was a child in Paris, being raised by a Greek dad who was reading Greek mythology to my brother and I so that we wouldn't forget that we were Greeks. You know, the Greeks are very proud of being Greek, even when they are become French. Well, that meant that somehow Greek mythology and these big stories are part of my DNA. And I started hearing them in that debate. And so little by little, these three meanings crystallize. I'm not arguing, Nicholas, that they're the only three meanings of Brexit. But there are three big meanings. So you ask me what they each mean. Well, Exodus actually goes back way before the Greeks, right? We're talking about the Bible and the somehow very strong sense from the Brexiteers that what Brexit really means is that we're leaving because we were a shackled people in Egypt / Pharaoh land. And we want to go to our promised land, break these shackles, and go to a land of milk and honey and let the people go, please. And so this is the story of Brexit as a British problem, a British weirdness, a British yearning. And as the Europeans become more and more fatigued by the whole story, they also have internalized that Exodus story. But of course, in every time I use stories, I tend to say, well, you know, it's always more complicated than that. The point about these great archetypes is that they're mysterious, ambiguous, and they raise more questions than they answer. And so with Exodus, we ask, well, how many tribes? What are the what is the fate of what happens in the wilderness? What is really a promise? Are you going to cross the sea? What happens to the UK when it's a former member state, just like the Hebrew created the pyramids and built the pyramids as slaves in Egypt? You know, we the Brits did a lot. And I say we the Brits, by the way, because in the meanwhile, I became British. So there's a whole set of questions and provocations that are raised by Exodus. But then I step back after a while and step back and say, is this really a British problem? Only a British problem? They better deal with it and they'd give us the solutions, say to the backstop? Maybe not. And I go back to the mindset that I really heard in Europe after the vote, which reminded me of 9/11 in the US. I lived there at the time. And when people reflected there, why do they hate us? What's our problem? There was a reflexive mood. There's been a reflexive mood in Europe for a while. And this is the story of reckoning that I say, reckoning with difficult truth and the need for very difficult conversations. Just like Oedipus had to reckon with his own truth, the fact that he discovers that, hey, you know, he killed his dad and slept with his mom for 20 years and had kids with her. I mean, that's a very difficult truth. Mythology is full of these difficult truths that you have to face. And so I ask, well, you know, how are we going to stab our eyes to see the truth in Europe today? What kind of truth? The kind of truth that here in Bruegel, I think researchers and all of you, you know, think very deeply about the nature of our economic system in Europe, the political economy, the type of capitalism we are developing, the winners and losers of this system, We know that this is what Brexit is also all about. It's about the tsunami of crisis that hit the EU, and whether we can't really think very hard about Brexit as a canary in the mine, that it's telling us bigger things. So in that part on reckoning, I explore all the questions that this raises about who is the people, what is sovereignty, what is geostrategic decline, how do we address the new politics of climate and time. And finally, and I, this is a last part that, depending on where you're coming from, either you think is maybe the most optimistic or pessimistic, I speak of a different understanding of Brexit as sacrifice. Just like Iphigenia was sacrificed by her dad, Agamemnon, so the Greeks could sell to Troy. There's always something sacrificed on the altar of something else. And here the idea is, well, you know, Britain, we sacrifice your membership on the altar of the greater good for the EU without the British veto and these headache-creating Brits who are always telling us their own versions of things. Well, you know, we can have a better Europe and we can go ahead and reinvent ourselves. And that's a kind of heroic notion of sacrifice. But I end up in sacrifice spending much more time talking about a different understanding of sacrifice, which is an ironic sacrifice. Always look at the bright side of life. And that's a very British thing, too. And in many ways, this is an ironic sacrifice. So this is, in a nutshell, the three mindset that I invite my reader to explore with me.
Mm. Well, can I ask you on this sacrifice notion? So one notion is Great Britain sacrifices itself so that the EU can succeed and can finally be united. And that was certainly a narrative, especially right after the referendum. There was a strong narrative, especially here in Brussels, but also in some member states, where the view was really, oh, once Great Britain is out, we on the continent, we will finally be able to unite and get together and solve our problems and not have this headache inside our club anymore. And I think in a recent presentation you mentioned, well, isn't it odd that we are so united on the United Kingdom, but we are not united on China, we are not united on our position towards the United States, we are not united on so many other issues. So why does this still seem to work? The British sacrifice still unites Europe, and we are still fairly united. What's your reading of this?
Well, indeed, isn't it a puzzle? There are so many geostrategic challenges for Europe where you would think we would be united, but no, because we have different material interests, different geographies and histories. And yet, yes, for 3 years now, we have our great leader, Michel Barnier, and even the heads of states are behind him when they generally are so tempted to tell their own truth. So in the book, well, I give my own interpretation, and I go back to my French roots, that of a great philosopher called René Girard, and he spent actually quite a few books telling us about le bouc émissaire, the scapegoat, the way in which societies are often chaotic, enter conflict, because there's such a thing as mimetic desire, when desire goes in circles and you want to kill each other because you desire the same thing or person, and that the only way in which societies find their harmony again, or at least their peace, social peace, is if they find indeed a scapegoat, often a group that is different enough so that you can put all of the conflict on that group, but similar enough that there's something at stake. And often a group that self-designates itself. There's a whole logic of scapegoating, which, of course, René Girard uses Oedipus and in Thebes to see how the city, which is in chaos, it has plague, it finds a way of concentrating all its ire and frustration on Oedipus and then becomes united again. But in doing so, of course, in the story of Oedipus, it doesn't really get to the real reason why, at least according to the mythology, why there was a sin in the first place. He takes on all the blame, but actually his dad is the one who'd kill someone and raped someone and was really awful, and I spare you the detail, you read the book. And it's pretty gory sometimes, you know, Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. But the point about it is that it doesn't matter who's really to blame or what really happened. As long as society can agree that at this moment in time, this is going to be a sacrificial victim. And you know, here in Bruegel, you've often talked about the fact that the EU has itself been a scapegoat for domestic politics. You know, what goes wrong is Brussels' fault, and what goes right is Paris's success, or Berlin's success, or Madrid's success. Yeah, we know that. But lately, people have become a bit more mature. They blame their own leaders. They vote them out too. You know, it's much more complicated than that. And also, Brussels is fighting back. And because Brexit is so existential, even if we deny it, it's so important for the identity of Europe. This is a moment when somehow in the European construct or its leaders or its collective psychology were drew upon this kind of old instinct that if we can only find a focus for our frustrations and difficulty and crisis, we'll be better off. And so in that very sense, Brexit came at the right time. And I do think that Britain gives us the perfect scapegoat because it's similar enough, central enough to Europe, especially if you contrast Britain to, say, the US or whatever. We are the same. We are Europeans, as the Brexiters like to say. Mm-hmm. But it's different enough, too, to be a scapegoat. And in that sense, this is in part how I explain how we keep our EU unity vis-a-vis Britain.
I read your essay in Standpoint in 2017.
Wow.
And a few of
these
sentences.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Oh, no, I really enjoyed it. And I have a couple of sentences which really stood out. The first one is, Brexit may be a bombshell in the European landscape, but the landscape had already been devastated by the policies and mindsets that betrayed... Sorry, I'll read that again. Brexit may be a bombshell in the European landscape, but the landscape had already been devastated by the policies and mindsets that betrayed its peoples. Are you referring to austerity there?
In part, absolutely. Mm. And I would ask our friends here in Bruegel if that wasn't in part the case. That, yes, of course, we are sitting here in Brussels, very close to EU institutions, and people will argue, and I can, in my technical mindset myself, say that, well, Brussels did the right thing because, after all, it was the capitals that messed it up, and starting with my Greece, where we had a state that was nepotistic, corrupt, and all the rest of it, we understand the ills of Greece. Yes, that's true, so the blame has to go there, too. But at the end of the day, the Brussels intervention didn't help things. And if we saw the rate of suicide, you know, multiply by X in Greece, I'm not going to give a number because this is too serious and 72% of statistics are made up on the spot. but yes, we've all thought very, very hard about it. You've written wonderful papers about winners and losers of the euro crisis. Mm-hmm. And the great suffering, which, you know, we have good counterfactuals that it could have been dealt differently. Even the IMF produced its own counterfactuals. That, you know, yes, you want to get your money back, but you don't have to kill the goose to do that. And that the kind of recipes that were used could have been smarter. Mm. And that the costs were real and profound and at the human level. So that we can say, and of course, this is true for the euro crisis. It's true for the refugee crisis. And it's true for the multiple difficulties that the EU had. So, yes, I am bothered by a discourse which says, you know, crisis comes from Wall Street, that's a financial crisis, from Palmyra and the Syrian crisis. But let's think about us.
But can I ask you, I mean, on this, I mean, you mentioned the refugee and the migration. And migration is, of course, also an ancient mythology theme. I mean, the migration, the exodus is a migration. But Brexit very much happened also in a context of fear of migration, right? And there was the big refugee inflow in 2015. And as you know, the Brexiteers... they campaigned on with pictures about showing the Syrian refugees walking into Germany and saying, well, get Brexit and stop this, right? We don't want this. And so I guess what I would love to hear from you is a bit this whole discussion around migration in the UK and how it has evolved. And what were the focal points and the critical points prior to the referendum also, and what could have been done differently? Was there a chance to actually prevent Brexit even by having a more generous deal with David Cameron at the time, where there was a discussion on limiting the free movement of labor somehow, but you know, the EU conceded very little at the time, and many actually now privately on the continent would say, well, if only at this fateful European Council, and I forgot the months, it was
February,
I think it was February 2016, if only at that fateful European Council we had sort of been a little bit more forthcoming towards David Cameron, perhaps we could have prevented Brexit altogether, because as you say, in the end, Britain is part of Europe, and it's close enough to really remain part of Europe and remain a strategic friend and ally. Walk us a bit through how you see this 2016 episode, 2015, 2016, the migration debate, both in Britain, but also this fateful European Council.
Guntram, I'm very interested to hear what you just said, that there is a revisiting in Brussels about this moment. This is not just pure idle game, because actually today in Europe we have to think about free movement of people across borders, which is the most beautiful of things, the best of things, but perhaps for some the worst of things. It has this dual face, this free movement. And indeed, the exodus is a metaphorical image of a country leaving the EU. You know, countries don't kind of leave, but it was against the background music of this fear of indeed refugees, as you described so well. And I completely agree with what you just said. We know that the places in Britain that voted Brexit in the highest proportion, like Boston in the north or Leeds or the north of Britain, were also places where there were huge increase. It's not so much about absolute numbers, but the increase of the rate of flow of free movement from the rest of the EU. And it's not surprising. And so it's the derivative that mattered. Right. The Economist had great graphs at the time about this, right? And why is that? It's pure common sense for our listeners. You know, it's because it's very hard for a country to build two cities of Oxford per year in the country, especially Britain. And they're not very good at these kinds of infrastructure. That is building schools and hospital and the rest of it, which make it okay to put in infrastructure. We can say that at a macro level, of course, the country gains more from its migrants or free movers than it would even need to spend if it did build the right infrastructure. But you don't do it so fast. It's hard. And so in the meanwhile, those who voted Brexit were those whose, you know, kids didn't have places in schools and didn't have, you know, beds in hospital. I think only a small proportion of them were rabid xenophobes or... yeah, of course, you always have in all of our countries xenophobes and those who reject the other. But these were real material concerns. And you could tell them, you know, well, refugees are good for the country, or migrants are good for, free movers are good for the country, but that's not what they felt. So yes, the background sociological reality is that. And then your question is the extent to which EU should have responded. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, was the Treaty of Rome and the whole European project conceived against such possibilities and contingencies of free movement really being very asymmetrical? Maybe because, ironically, Britain is too attractive, you know. So it left the EU because it was too attractive to Europeans. That's an irony for you. and because it was too liberal, and because it miscalculated in 2004 when Blair said, let's not have 7 years of transition, right, and take our time. Wow, that was kind of cool for all the Poles and Hungarians who could come, and Eastern Europeans or Southern Europeans. We have 500,000 Greeks, you know, in Britain today. So that's also a bit later. But the point is, what could Britain do? And they were desperate. They were asking for help. And the construct of Europe should be able to rely on its law, to do it legally, not to force a country to do it illegally, especially for Britain, which is a stickler for European law. Some other countries, they just close their borders. They don't care. Who cares about Europe? But the Brits, you know, they can't do it. It's in their DNA. They have to be legal. They've got to get an agreement. So here's Cameron begging for some sort of emergency break. And we know that actually there are articles in the treaties on public good that could have been invoked to legalize that demand, that request from Britain. So, you know, Guntram, I mean, how do we know? Counterfactuals, sure. You know. But it's important to enter in this imaginative game of the world where, you know, the wars turn out differently or whatever, because they tell us where we made mistakes, where we were successful, and really thinking hard of what we could have done differently. And I actually personally believe, having done the campaign very intensely in 2015-16, that if I could have said we have an emergency break, you know, Europe is flexible, don't worry, free movement, you know, we can cope, I myself on the campaign trail would have felt much more comfortable and on strong ground. And Farage wouldn't have had the possibility to use the metaphors that he used.
This leads me to another sentence I really liked from your essay, which I highlighted and underlined immediately. Quote, across Europe, fingers pointed at the other within rotate towards the Union, bent on chipping away community's most fundamental collective instinct, the capacity to exclude. And I want to I want to ask you why that capacity to exclude is so important, but I also want to highlight a statistic I remember from Britain. Two numbers that are very easy to remember, 13 and 31. If you ask British people what percentage of the population are migrants, the average answer you get is 31%, but the real figure is just 13%. So it's possible that if we had, quote unquote, controlled migration in 2016, ordinary British people might not have even noticed because their perception of how many migrants are within their communities are completely inflated.
Well, this is a good counter, Nicholas. I agree with you. And I think our first instincts as liberal, cosmopolitan, tolerant people, progressives, call us whatever we want to call ourselves, you know, we are types, or, okay, I can just speak for myself, but my instinct is to include. I mean, I've spent my life preaching inclusion, inclusion of the other, whether Europeans or outside Europe, by the way, obviously. That's the kind of society we dream of. But on the other hand, and so, you know, you would want people to have this instinct. You want this to be part of education and schools and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, we've built with our, you know, democracies, our capitalist democracies, something quite amazing, which is called the welfare state. Mm. And of course, you know, the kind of capitalism we've also helped develop in the last 20 years has chipped away at this welfare state. We know that the ratio of capital to labor income has increased exponentially over the last, and has continued to do so even after the financial crisis, even at the same rate. And we know how deeply problematic this is. In fact, there we have huge debates of the extent and how we can reinvent our capitalism, whether it's even possible, whether it's run away already. And so if that's the case, then we just need to ask, how do we save the welfare state? Because it is an instrument of social solidarity, of dignity, and not necessarily always of equality. And our welfare states are very, very wounded, and they don't always work well. But as my former colleague Danny Roderick at Harvard wrote so beautifully, you know, the more a state trades, the more it needs a welfare state, and in fact, the two go together, openness and welfare state, so that you can cushion the shocks. But at the same time, we know very well in Europe that, you know, our equilibrium is to find very fine and subtle balances of inclusion and exclusion. That's why, for instance, we don't just give open up access to our health services across Europe. We do it in a really balanced way. The European Court of Justice judgments are very balanced on that. It kind of depends, you know, and this is true across issues. So we want to always balance these two forces of inclusion and exclusion. That's my analytical answer to you, Nicholas. But because you were so kind to quote my my take on the finger that is pointed at Brussels, who keeps us from the right to exclude, when I say something like this, I am trying to express in a certain kind of prose what I hear people thinking. It doesn't mean I necessarily agree with them. It's a kind of sociological reading. This is the yearning of people. So you're 30, you know, they may be wrong. They read the numbers differently. They have distorted perception because they oversee what they don't like. Mm. That is true. But we still need to hear them. If they're distorted, correct the perception, address them. And at the end of the day, the last point I want to add on right to exclude is that there are even some philosophers that are progressive and write about something that goes beyond right to exclude, which they call duty to exclude. Mm. Because when we see a state like Rwanda or Nigeria, or some states in Africa, who spend a huge portion of their GDP training nurses up to the age of 20-something, who would then go to Berlin or to London to help our health services when we haven't spent anything to train them. So the brain drain and skill drain that we see, you want to think about that and the extent to which we shouldn't actually, if not exclude them, because they as individuals don't deserve it. They want to earn money for their families and have a better future. But think of a world where migration is much more circular, where we think of the inclusion of the other as also a way of re-including them at some other point in their home community. And that's true, for instance, for Syrian refugees too. So all I'm trying to say is it's a very
complex debate. No, I mean, I think there were lots of points there on which one could react, obviously. And I guess I only want to react on two points. I mean, one point is obviously that the cost of emigration, which you alluded to the society that is sending people, is actually something that is quite controversially debated. And we are having our own research program at this stage on exactly that question, where we sort of question the basic assumption that it's just a cost. Because, yes, it's true there's a cost in terms of training people that you described. But there's also remittances that are very significant. And in fact, there's often at some stage also circular migration. So people do come back after 20 years, 30 years, when the economic situation has improved, depending on the country. So I think the overall sort of fiscal balance of this is not so clear. And there's a big discussion on this. And we have just started a research project exactly on that question. I guess the other quick point on which I did want to react is this question of the welfare state, which is of course absolutely fundamental. And I guess we both agree that the British government has quite neglected significant parts of its welfare state, including the NHS, and the fact that the campaign, so the National Health Service, and the fact that the campaign with the bus bring back, what is it, 350 million per week to the NHS. I mean, this was very much a campaign that played to, of course, what people saw, namely lots of more demand on the NHS, but not more resources. The real political question at the time should have been, well, why didn't the government provide for that kind of money already? Because, and you know, I think it was also related to an ideology of austerity that the UK had prior to the referendum. Now, I agree with you that it's more difficult to provide welfare and health services in a more diverse society, that societal consensus is more difficult to achieve. But in the end, it seems to me there is a whole dimension of also misguided macro policies prior to the referendum that where I would put quite a bit of blame for the referendum result. Now, we don't have very much time, but there's perhaps one point which we can.
Can I just say very quick point? One is on circular migration. A while back, we were praising so much circular migration in Europe with blue passports 10 years ago, talking about this, because for many, many reasons that you allude to, Guntram, but including because if people are going to go back home, say they're in Berlin and they want to go back to, you know, South Africa. They need to know that they can come back because they've left friends, family, know-how. So this is the real meaning of circular. So we shouldn't in Europe think, oh, they'll be here for a while and then leave. It's all about organizing this circulation, rethinking migration, really at the world level. It's such a big issue. And I'm so glad to hear that you're doing all this wonderful work here in Bruegel about this. And on your point on the welfare state, absolutely, I couldn't agree more with everything you just said and British macro policy and all of that. But, you know, it's worth reminding our listeners that this state, which is called such things as, you know, big Singapore on the Thames, it will become that, and deregulation Britain, etc., you know, is the most communist state in Europe. It has the most collectivist health service. Let's never forget this. You know, I've lived there for 20 years, never spent a cent on health. It's quite a magnificent achievement that they genuinely love. And of course, it has huge problems because you have to fund such a huge machine. But it's such a great, ironic corrective to the impression that so many continentals have of Britain.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk perhaps the last few minutes about the backstop in Ireland? Because you're also a trade expert and you have your views on this whole discussion on what to do with Northern Ireland and the Belfast Agreement, and trying to make sure that the Belfast Agreement doesn't fall apart, while at the same time respecting the sovereignty of the United Kingdom and the sovereignty of the EU on its own territory, both in terms of customs as well as in terms of regulation. I'm sure you touch on this also in your book. I mean, perhaps we also want to tie it back to the book. Where do you see this backstop discussion currently, and where would you like it to end, perhaps?
Well, of course, we are speaking right now in mid-October, where this is the issue yet again. And you know, it's not surprising that the backstop haunts us, because what we call in social science a wicked problem, or in it's also a Greek tragedy, you know, where there's no right solution. There is no solution. It's an impossible dilemma. Mm-hmm. And why is it the case? Well, we all know the basics, that the EU is an entity, is a machine that creates external borders. That's what it does, because it has no internal borders in trade, in movement of people. So it has to have, for better or worse, and it's very costly for lives in the Mediterranean and very terrible. But that's the way it is. So when Poland comes in, Ukraine-Poland has suddenly a border, which is very costly for the social fabric there. But that's what the EU does. And now with Britain leaving the EU, we have to create an external border in the EU, where in a place where it's absolutely forbidden and impossible to create a border. How do you do that? You have to create a border. You cannot create a border. It's a terrible, impossible problem. And I wish that from the beginning, all sides would have said that all together and said, let's sit on the same side of the table, facing that problem and trying to resolve it together. Since you, Britain, want to leave the EU, we're going to let you leave the EU, because as I argue by the end of the book, by doing this, you're really demonstrating that indeed the EU is not a prison, that you can leave it. Well, we don't like it. Me personally, as an author, I don't like it. But that's the case. So let's see how we can do this. Now, the EU is very Cartesian, very rational, very legal. Some people would say dogmatic, not just among the Brexiters, because it says, well, there are only two ways to do this. Well, there are three ways. You know, the third way is one day there might be magical unicorn technologies that will allow us to govern everything from the skies, and then we'll be okay. But the other regulatory ways are to say, well, either we keep the whole of Ireland in one regulatory space and one customs union, so basically it stays in the EU, or we do the same for all of the UK until one day when we have a solution. Now, my question is, I mean, I see that one sees the logic. It's very, very logical, and that's, in a way, makes sense. But then why don't we ask, well, if it's the whole of Ireland, you know, would any other EU country, continent, you know, a big part of itself being in a different jurisdiction? just different place, and especially with such sensitivities at stake. Would, you know, France do this with Corsica? Now, the answer comes back saying, well, you know, let's de-dramatize, and it's no big deal, and it's a few checks. But, you know, sorry, jurisdictional sovereignty is one of these things. And then on the other hand, you say, well, okay, you can do this, so the whole of the UK, which is what Theresa May at the end demanded, and the Europeans were wise to not like it, but and perhaps also wise to let her have it, both. You can say both contradictory things at the same time. Not great either for a Brexiter who wants to do the deluded thing, I think, of having their own trade deal in the rest of the world without EU bargaining power. But that's their own craziness. Let them own their craziness. So both of these proposals, solutions, don't work from an UK viewpoint. And so the backstop has been those two solutions. That's the Theresa May backstop. And the Boris Johnson approach is throw all this in the sea and let's find a kind of middle way or whatever it is. And here we're at a moment, and of course, you know, we can all say, well, his middle way is very problematic. And mm-hmm. I say that too. And let me just simply give you the two examples where it is problematic, but where I would argue that we can work at it. So one is that he's said very rightly, and I think the EU approves, we need to democratize the backstop. Mm-hmm. We need to let the locals own it.
Right.
But the problem is he's done that in a very clumsy way. Mm. People call it the Stormont lock, but it basically means Northern Ireland Assembly every 4 years says yes and no.
Right.
There are more creative ways to democratize the backstop. And the default should not be that, well, if they don't get their act together, we all throw it up in the air yet again, and they come out and we recreate the problem. So let's try to be creative together on that first thing. And of course, the biggest thing is whether we need checks anywhere, somewhere on the island of Ireland. And of course, the Brits say, we don't want any check. Ireland says, we don't want any check. But the EU says, rightly, well, we have the integrity of the single market, so we need checks. But then we need to ask the EU, can we be more creative as we can? Mobile checks, indeed checks from the sky, regulatory mutual recognition of certification, sorry to be jargony and technical here, but just to allude to your listener that there are technical creative solutions that have been discussed in the academia and in very obscure policy circles. The bigger point is that eventually we will find creative solutions. And I really, really hope that as we move from Brexit 1.0 to Brexit 2.0, the mindset of all of us, negotiators, academics, think tank thinkers, you know, Bruegel work, will be about this creativity. And I say this in a very cognizant way, because I totally and hugely appreciate that the work that Bruegel has done in the spirit of differentiation geographically, differentiation between free movement and different types of free movement. So I know we are like-minded on this, and I hope we can all contribute to a more flexible, kinder, smarter approach to this tremendous moment that we're living in, where Britain is leaving the EU.
Well, we've been talking for half an hour now, and it has been fascinating. Just before we end, I'm going to have to request a very brief extension, because, Guntram, I would like to ask you if Brexit and the ensuing negotiations, how have they changed the way you think about the European project?
Oh, wow, that's a tough one.
Now you're on the spot.
Well, I certainly have been impressed by the unity of the EU, but I've also been, I have to say, a little bit disappointed by perhaps the lack of longer-term strategic thinking about what to do with this very important neighbor, the UK.
Can we just continue a tiny bit on this, since we've only had
go ahead,
an hour,
yeah.
Or do you think we should, you know, because...
You can carry
really
on. There's something you'd like to
but
add
I don't
on.
Want to sound like, because you were making it sound like it was the end, so I don't,
no, that's
you
okay,
know, you
go
don't
on.
Want your listener to think we're supposed to finish, we're not finishing or whatever. But, I mean, it's such an important point, I think, to ask, to link the discussions we're having that are so passionate about, at the end of the day, rather technical issues. And would there be smuggling? And where will there be checks? And will the toys be safe? You know, and to me, this sounds a bit besides the point, because actually Britain and the EU will be compatible in very fundamental ways, you know, for a long, long time. Britain is not a runaway deregulator and all of that. But what's really, really important is what Guntram just said. Strategically, Britain and the rest of Europe really belong together. We see it again and again, you know, when we work on Iran and the Middle East and Latin America and the whole world. We are so close. We share values and geostrategic values. And so I would be shocked if the kind of macho politics that we tend to see right now would blind us to the strategic issues, challenges. What's at stake here is very, very big. And the fact that, so to me, we need to step back and not link, you know, foreign policy and our trade agreement, not link in a formal way. Sometimes the Brexiters do this and it's infuriating, you know, alluding to, oh, well, maybe we won't cooperate on defense or terrorism if you don't give us the right deal. That is deeply wrong, this bargaining linkage. Mm. But while this is wrong, what is true is that the two are linked in a bigger strategic way in terms of mood music, political mood music, that if the whole thing is hugely acrimonious on trade, then it's going to be really hard to work together, you know, in Africa or in the Middle East or vis-a-vis China. So I think that we need to try to keep this in mind so that in the name of our strategic friendship and togetherness for, the next decades, I don't want to be too grand here, and take climate change.
Sure.
We are so close and we can do so much together. That in the name of that, we need to really, really make efforts to be on the same side of the table on trade. So I'm with Guntram, I'm just trying to say it.
The book is Exodus, Reckoning, Sacrifice, Three Meanings of Brexit. It's out now. Calypso, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thank you for having me in Bruegel.
And thank you, Guntram.
Thank you.
See you next time. Bruegel means Bruegel, and we are going to make the best of it.